This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how much power can a U.S. president have? We are now 1 month into President Trump's second term, and he's signed at least 70 executive orders. His first few weeks back in office have been marked by big moves made quickly, from pardoning 1,500 January 6th rioters, to attempting to stop all foreign aid, to mass firings and buyouts to shrink the number of federal employees. Many of the administration's actions have been challenged in court as illegal or unconstitutional, and judges have ordered some policies paused while lawsuits work their way through the courts. The question at the heart of almost all these cases is, does a president have the power to do this? Should they?
Executive power has been expanding over recent decades, but what Trump has really attempted to do in the last few weeks is push things much further.
That's Ankush Kadori, a senior writer with Politico magazine and a former federal prosecutor. Ankush says the ways in which Trump is testing the boundaries of executive power could fundamentally reshape the office of the presidency and its balance with Congress and the federal courts.
Trump is really trying to take all of this to sort of a new level. And I think also what is quite distinctive is he's moving on multiple constitutional fronts at the same time.
I sat down with Ankush earlier this week to ask him how we have watched the power of the executive branch expand over time and what makes Trump an outlier. But I started by asking him to address a question that Trump's critics are asking, which is, are we in a constitutional crisis?
Let me just level set by saying legal scholars generally define a constitutional crisis to refer to a conflict between the branches, two branches of government that cannot be resolved through normal legal processes. Technically, we are not there yet if you hold that definition. We would be reaching a constitutional crisis if Trump said he was going to defy court orders or even the Supreme Court orders down the line. But he, in recent weeks, he and his administration officials have actually been seeming to go to pains to say that they will abide by the courts. His solicitor general just this past weekend emphasized that in a filing that they put into the Supreme Court. So, you know, I understand why people are very concerned about this. The volume and intensity of what Trump is doing are quite different than what we've normally seen. And they do raise serious constitutional questions that get to core issues in our democracy. But I don't think we're quite at crisis point yet. And I'm hoping that maybe the temperature can come down just a little bit.
Well, let's talk about the legal nuances here and what we do see as challenging the limits as set by the Constitution and talk about some specifics, right? So we saw that the Trump administration is now asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on the firing of the head of the Office of Special Counsel. Now, this is the first time that the Trump administration is asking SCOTUS to weigh in on his actions. What is the legal argument here? How is this a test of the president's power?
So the legal argument here draws on a unitary executive theory that conservatives have advanced over decades now. And the argument is essentially that the president has unfettered authority to dismiss officials in the executive branch, irrespective of what Congress may have written into the law. And usually for these very high-profile positions, things like the head of this particular office of special counsel, inspectors general, heads of independent agencies, the president is not supposed to be able to remove these people except for cause, or for instance, or waste or neglect or failure to carry out their duties. And he has not even attempted to invoke those circumstances here. So Hampton Dellinger is the head of the Office of Special Counsel, but he is a single official in that capacity. So this case, actually, I don't think would necessarily move the law that much, simply because in 2020, the Supreme Court held that it was permissible for the president to remove the head of a single member body. In that case, it was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. However, in some ways, the Dellinger case, the one we're talking about right now, is sort of an outlier, actually, because what Trump really wants to do and what the, you know, Republican Party and conservative lawyers really want to do is overrule a very old case known as Humphrey's executor, which also makes it illegal for the president to remove members of multi-member commissions. In that case, it was the Federal Trade Commission. So what Trump is going to be asking them to do eventually, particularly in the context of the dismissal of members of the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board, he will be asking the Supreme Court to extend the decision from 2020 and probably to reverse the decision from way back when. I think it was 1935. And that would affect a real sea change in the law, because it would effectively liberate the president to fire anyone within the executive branch at will, even if they're there because Congress has thought they were creating an independent agency that would be insulated from those sorts of pressures.
So what you're saying is this is kind of a stepping stone move to expand his oversight over these kinds of positions even more broadly.
That is absolutely correct. And that is why I think that they were so quick and so expansive with these firings, particularly in the independent agencies. And in fact, I think the administration has effectively said they're going to seek the overruling at some point of that decision that I just mentioned. So that would be a very significant change in the law. It would significantly expand the powers of the presidency, and it would significantly diminish the power of Congress.
What is the argument here against the president being allowed to hire and fire people in the executive branch?
Well, one is a basic one, which is that the ability to make laws in the Constitution rests with Congress. And for the last half century or so, since the New Deal, we've relied heavily on independent agencies to effectuate the laws that Congress passes. Things like the CFPB, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, and on and on and on. So the effort to insulate those agencies from political forces was intentional, right? It was designed to elevate the expertise and impartiality of those bodies. Often they have to be balanced by partisan affiliation. And that shores up the integrity of the work that they do and also helps stabilize that work over time, right? So that you won't see radical changes from one administration to the next. If you can fire the heads of these agencies, the inspectors, generals, the members of all these commissions, if Trump can do it, then so can the next president, right? The next potential Democratic presidents, for instance, the next president in a new party. And that is just going to make it impossible for there to be any real regulatory stability across administrations.
You know, I've heard a lot of people bring up this example, this historical example, which is that Reagan fired a large number of inspectors general as well, similarly to Trump. I believe it was 16 inspectors general when he was in office in the 80s, and there was a lot of pushback at the time to his move.
Well, look, the law has changed since then. Congress has tightened up, actually, in this area and attempted to even make it harder for presidents like Reagan to do things like that. But I do think it's a very good point that you raise, and one that I'm trying to draw attention to as people talk about, you know, for instance, the constitutional crisis and the changes here. A lot of these arguments have their roots in conservative legal thinking that goes back many decades, not just to the Reagan administration, but even to the Nixon administration. I'm sure we'll get to the impoundment stuff and spending stuff eventually. But, you know, those administrations, Nixon, Reagan, the George W. Bush administration, they really served as incubators for these ideas. And as, you know, five of the six Republican appointees on the Supreme Court worked in those administrations in senior capacities, all of them but Amy Coney Barrett. And those administrations pushed pretty expansive executive powers. They were not as aggressively as Trump has done or as quickly as Trump has done, but they pushed variations on this stuff. So this isn't quite new, but Trump is really trying to take all of this to sort of a new level.
So how do you think this Supreme Court question about firing the head of this one agency might play out?
Well, okay, so right now before them is the question of whether to even take the case right now, while the lower court proceedings have not even concluded. That they should turn away, and I hope that should be an easy one for them to turn away, because it is so obvious. If they let him do it now, he's going to be going running straight to them anytime he gets a ruling that he doesn't like. Once the Hampton-Dellinger case actually is in front of the Supreme Court, whether they take it now or it sort of goes through the normal process and gets there, you know, months if not years from now, or he could prevail on that one. And he could actually end up prevailing in most if not all of these cases involving the firings of the inspectors general and the independent agencies. There are indications there because the law, they have been sort of moving the law in this direction for a while. And plenty of people think sort of the tea leaves are sort of favorable to Trump, at least on this one. I think the firings of all these people, again, the inspectors general and the like, whatever one makes of it on the merits, is probably the area where he's on his strongest footing and likeliest to get some traction at the Supreme Court. Which is not to say he won't get traction on these other things, but this one, like, the law has been moving in the direction, and I think this is a very sympathetic court on these issues.
Well, let's actually move into talking about impoundment and getting into as much of that history as you'd like to. I mean, can you explain what it is first, presidential impoundment power?
The concept of impoundment refers to the idea that the president can refuse to spend certain funds that have been allocated by Congress. This, too, is not a new idea. Nixon argued that he had this power, but he did not attempt to take it this far. Congress passed a law called the Impoundment Control Act in part to make clear that the executive branch did not have this power and that if they wanted to impound certain funds, they needed to go back to Congress and pass a certain, pursue certain procedural steps and consult with Congress.
And that impoundment law was passed in the 70s.
Correct.
Right?
I would say there's one other major data point jurisprudentially on this issue, and that is the Supreme Court's decision in the 1990s to strike down the line item veto.
Under Clinton, right?
Correct, right.
During the Clinton years.
And it's very, very interesting that history, the line item veto passed with robust bipartisan support, and Clinton supported it too. So this was an idea that had support, like very robust support in the political branches, but the Supreme Court held that it was unconstitutional because effectively the line item veto gave the president an end run around the constitutionally mandated practice for passing laws. Basically said that line item veto gives the power of the president to repeal or amend laws, and the court said that doesn't work. You can't do that. It's unconstitutional. Mm. And the majority at that time tellingly included Justice Clarence Thomas. And, you know, unfortunately, we're going to have to, as we proceed through the months and years, test some propositions here, including whether Clarence Thomas joined the majority because it was a Democratic president or whether he will stick to his principles when this, you know, these sorts of spending cases come up to the Supreme Court again.
So what do you think could happen if this issue reaches the Supreme Court and it decides to clear the way for the president to exercise impoundment power?
Well, look, this to me is perhaps the most radical of his moves because it would completely usurp the power of the purse from Congress. And there is a reason that Congress, our legislature, has that power, right? Because they are far more responsive and representative of the country as a whole and can aggregate the interests of their constituents throughout the country, which vary across demographics and geography and things like that. And we have this very complex process. It's messy. It's far from perfect, right? But that is the process that is supposed to generate our budgets. And for the president to be able to say, well, I don't care what Congress wrote, I get to pick and choose how the money is spent, would be a remarkable expansion of the executive authority and a remarkable diminution of Congress's authority. But, you know, one thing that Trump and I think the Supreme Court are going to need to grapple with is that, you know, when a president tries to acquire one of these new tools, it's not just a tool for him, it's a tool for his successors too. This is a mistake that many presidents have made throughout American history, not really appreciating that the power that they want for themselves is a power that goes to their successors too. So I don't think it's a good idea, just as a matter of political hygiene, for us to have a country where every 4 or 8 years, whenever a new party takes control, there can be a total overhaul of the government. And one of the things that I think Trump has done inadvertently that has somewhat weakened his legal position across these cases is over the past few weeks, they have demonstrated precisely what is wrong with giving the executive branch this sort of authority. What we've seen over the last few weeks, particularly with Elon Musk, has been total chaos. What he's been doing is opaque. What they have been doing is targeting agencies that they dislike for political purposes. And they have been ginning up mostly false, if not entirely false, claims of fraud and waste in these agencies.
Right. No evidence. They haven't provided evidence of fraud.
They have not provided evidence from fraud. All Elon Musk does is post out-of-context screenshots from public websites he just discovered like a few days ago. I mean, the whole thing is just, it would be laughable if it were in a film, but it's now real life. And the problem is that judges read the news too, and judges live in this country too. So I would hope that the Supreme Court would take note of the implications of accepting Trump's position because we are seeing them in real time and we are incurring them in real time. And the American public is going to incur them in real time too as the effects of all this slashing of the workforce and cutting of the budgets invariably trickles down to the district level.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, a major reason that Trump keeps talking about for doing it this way and doing all of these actions is to cut spending, to rein in spending, which a lot of Americans find appealing on its face, right? Reining in spending, rooting out corruption. These are popular ideas, generally and broadly speaking. I mean, when Clinton cut a bunch of federal jobs, I mean, Bill Clinton is credited with reining in federal spending and getting the budget under control, getting deficit under control. How does Trump's argument compare historically to how other presidents have talked about reining in spending and perhaps testing their executive powers in doing so?
Yeah, well, like, you know, Clinton, for whatever flaws he may have had, did attempt to go through formal processes, things like creating commissions and the like and conducting studies, which Trump has done none of that, mm-hmm. right? He has just come in and had Elon Musk just sort of move unilaterally. There's been no process, not even really the like facade of a process or the pretense of a process or any sort of consultation with Congress or any evidence really that they thought much about what they're doing. Again, we are seeing that in real time, right? They're firing people and then having to call them back at these agencies now. And it is going to disrupt Americans' lives. And in the worst case scenario, you know, it is possible that we could incur some very unfortunate event as a result of so quickly and arbitrarily slashing the federal workforce.
Mm. It sounds like what you're describing is executive power encroaching on legislative power, the power of Congress. So if that's the case, where is Congress here? Like, where is the legislature?
That is an excellent question. I mean, look, Republicans control both houses of Congress. They are the ones, or at least some of them, who would need to stand up. For instance, by refusing to confirm some of Trump's cabinet nominees. That would be the easiest way for some of them to push back. That isn't happening because mm-hmm. Republicans are silently acquiescing, or in some cases explicitly acquiescing, and they are ceding their authority to Trump. Now, this may be politically convenient at the moment because it allows Trump to slash a bunch of things that they can then, you know, bake into the budget. So I understand that there's sort of a political benefit to them sort of tacitly coordinating in this way. But the question of where is Congress is very, very important here, because historically, and our Constitution relies on this, there is supposed to be a healthy amount of tension and competition between our three branches of government. They're supposed to check one another and also stand up for their own institutional prerogatives. And that is supposed to be a healthy and essential part of how our democracy works, with each branch exercising its power to check the other branches and without just rolling over. And so what the Republicans are doing here, I think, is dangerous over the long term and could hobble Congress over the long term unless something changes here, either in the way of the legislative dynamics or the Supreme Court.
Hmm. You know, as Trump was assuming office, there was so much talk about the fact that, well, now, you know, he's stepping into the presidency. What's different this time around is that he has both chambers of Congress. That's going to make things a lot easier for him. Why not encourage legislation that allows some of these changes to happen? Why use executive power to do it?
Because a lot of this is unpopular and would not pass in Congress, and the public would be angry about it if they heard that their representatives were doing these things, and they might vote them out of office. That's why, including next year in the 2026 midterms. It is a politically convenient way for them to avoid any responsibility for the things that they actually want to occur here in terms of, again, radically sort of shrinking the federal government and expanding the power of the executive branch.
So let's talk now about some of the ways in which Trump's moves are challenging the judicial branch and its power. We're hearing a lot about how Trump might ignore lower court rulings. As you've said, he has indicated that he's following lower court rulings so far, but a lot of his allies have encouraged him to ignore them, right? What can you tell us about that strategy, if there is one?
It's a terrible strategy to ignore court orders at any level. And I think Trump understands that. And I think that's why he and his acting solicitor general have gone through pains in recent days. And even anonymous aides, White House aides, have been telling reporters that they are going to abide by the court orders below and to the Supreme Court. The reason why I think, or an important reason why I think he is likely to hold to that position, is because it is in his self-interest and in the Republican Party's self-interest to do so. This is a moment that the Republican Party has been waiting for a long time, decades, right? They have been waiting to have a Supreme Court that is stacked with their appointees, which they now have, 6-3, including 3 Trump appointees, and five of whom have, you know, very probably some inclination toward expansive views of executive power, and also a president who is willing to push those boundaries and who may not need to face, or who should not face, another election. And they've already achieved many of their goals through the Supreme Court, most notably including overturning Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. This is the most sympathetic Supreme Court to Republican and conservative political priorities that we've seen in our lifetimes. They know this. Trump knows this, particularly because they literally kind of just bailed him out of prison last summer when they gave him immunity in the 2020 election subversion case, 6-3. Mm-hmm. All the Republicans. So if Trump understands nothing else about how the Supreme Court works, I'm sure he understands that.
Hmm. But I mean, don't you think the work has already begun of undermining the legitimacy of the courts?
Well, look, it is unfortunate that we've had Vice President J.D. Vance undermining the courts, Elon Musk and some other prominent Republicans like Senator Mike Lee. It's very unfortunate.
Yeah. I mean, Vance literally said judges are not allowed to control the executive's legitimate power.
Which is actually a silly tautology and begs the question. Because the question is, what is the scope of the executive authority? Not what can he do within that discretionary area. So this is definitely not helpful to have these prominent people doing this. And it does undermine confidence in the courts. And I think part of it is an attempt to sort of game the Supreme Court, right? And perhaps even to try to intimidate some of those lower court judges.
When you're saying game the system, you mean by pushing these cases up to the Supreme Court. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, or also just saying, like, look, these judges are radical and out of control at the lower court level. And if they were to help generate that sentiment more broadly, I do think that could conceivably put some sort of indirect pressure on the Supreme Court.
There are so many other actions by Trump to talk about. I wonder if maybe you want to bring up some examples that you're thinking about a lot that you think might get resolved in the courts. Of course, there's birthright citizenship. There's mass deportations. There's attacks on the rights of transgender people. What are you watching closely as examples of how presidential power is being expanded and really tested right now?
Yeah, here's one that hasn't gotten much attention. Trump has filed, Trump's Justice Department under Pam Bondi, has filed two lawsuits against Illinois and New York, alleging that sanctuary laws that they passed, which limit local law enforcement's ability to cooperate with federal law enforcement on immigration matters, are unconstitutional and should be struck down. This is a pretty significant position because there's a whole line of cases in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence which is supposed to prevent the federal government from commandeering, effectively taking over state and local law enforcement or government activities for the purposes of advancing federal interests. Mm. And it is possible that, you know, Trump and the Justice Department may eventually succeed in one or more of those lawsuits simply because the issue, among others, concerns immigration, and the courts, particularly the Supreme Court, tend to be quite deferential on that issue. But I think if they open this sort of can up, it's going to be a problem because you can say it's just for immigration now, but, you know, these things take on a life of their own over the sweep of history. And we've had a very, very long tradition in this country of what's known as dual federalism, right? We have a federal government and we have states that are supposed to have their own autonomous governmental structures. So for the Justice Department to come in and basically say law enforcement officials in Illinois and New York must help them with enforcing federal immigration law, I think that's a pretty aggressive position. And I think it is one that we should be attentive to because I think the implications are serious and could eventually go beyond immigration.
Well, also, it's a move away from small government toward big government thinking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, much of this is inconsistent with what we tend to think about conservatism as a political proposition, right? Now, it's true at the federal level, they're shrinking government. That's consistent with having a small government. But what is supposed to complement that is having states and local governments be able to do their own thing without the federal government sort of riding herd on them or directing them. And likewise, I thought it used to be the case that conservatives were wary of centralized power that could be wielded arbitrarily and with little accountability, little to no accountability. But that is what they're sort of all signing on for when they're letting Trump get away with all these things.
Hmm. Can we talk very quickly, before I let you go, about presidential pardons? I mean, we have seen Trump pardon 1,500 people in connection to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Biden pardoned a lot of people in office. In his last hours in office, Biden pardoned several members of his family, saying it was to protect them from any possible politically motivated investigations by the Trump administration. How was Biden's move an expansion of presidential power? And how are Trump's moves an expansion of that power, too? I think both got criticized in different ways and for very different reasons, but I'd like for you to speak to both, if you could.
Yeah, no, they were both criticized and both worthy of criticism, though I think still quite different. So the Biden pardons of his family members, we have not seen anything like that before, right? And in fact, the president, Biden, had said he wasn't going to pardon his son, I think, at various points.
Yeah.
But here's what I'll say about that. The government, Republicans in Congress, and the special counsel that was appointed during the Trump administration to investigate Hunter Biden, they have been investigating the Biden family for years. I would have hoped that if there were federal crimes they wanted to charge the Biden family with, that would have happened by now. And in fact, they did charge Hunter Biden of two crimes which, frankly, had no real practical precedent. And at the same time, you know, Trump campaigned on imprisoning the Biden crime family. That is how he referred to them, right? So he was very overt in his threats. Republicans in Congress for years were claiming that the Bidens were guilty of criminal conduct, but were never able to substantiate it credibly. So I think, you know, as unseemly as it may appear, there is sort of a logic to what Biden did that is not available to what Trump did. What Trump did, pardoning 1,500 people, is in a very different category to me, because it is entirely about his self-interest, revising the narrative around the January 6th siege of the U.S. Capitol. And it's much worse, I think. Obviously, it's much larger, right? 1,500 people.
Right.
I think it's sort of qualitatively different than what Biden did. And however critical one might be of the Biden pardon, which I'm not really a fan of, I still think what Trump did is way worse. And I think it's showing up in the polling, too. I mean, this was already an unpopular proposition even before the election, pardoning all these people. Since mm-hmm. then, the polling has sort of moved even further against this. I saw a poll actually just today that Pew put out a while ago in which like something like 74% of the respondents opposed pardons for violent offenders on that day. I mean, people intuitively understand that this is bad.
Mm. So, Ankush, what do you think people should be thinking about as they're digesting the news these days, trying to understand how we're watching presidential power change?
Yeah. You know, it's challenging, I think, for the average American simply because these are, right, obviously there's complicated issues and there are many of them kind of floating up at once.
Yeah.
I would encourage people, rather than necessarily following the day-to-day, which people like me do, to try to take a step back and read more step-back pieces, for instance. You know, the firings are not disconnected from the spending freezes. They're all cohere into a very expansive vision of the presidential power and, as I said, a radical diminution of the power of Congress and our elected representatives. And I think specifically, if there were one thing I think people can and will and should pay attention to, it is how the spending issues get resolved, because that is going to impact real people real quickly. And I would pay very close attention to that issue, perhaps above all, because if he gets away with that, and what he's doing at the agencies, which is sort of a piece, sort of draining these agencies and effectively defunding and quote-unquote deleting them, as Elon Musk says, that would be a radical change in our government, and it would create a system that would be very, very vulnerable to corruption and, frankly, already is.
Mm. Ankush, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Ankush Karduri is a senior writer for Politico magazine. You can read his latest column on Apple News. We'll link to it on our show notes page.